Last night, if I would touch a little bit on a topic I spoke about recently at another event, about questions of the modern challenges to the ethic of Lashon Hara that come from the internet culture. So yeah, I responded, I'll talk about that if Rishon would like, but maybe also in the spirit of Mishra Nichnas Adar, that we're now, even though it's the extra Adar, but it still is evocative of Purim, anytime you have the word Adar, even if it's 6 weeks away, maybe to start thinking about how it's relevant to that also in terms of the phenomenon in the yeshiva world of the Purim spiel, and maybe how these issues come together. And look at some of the relevant sugyas and see how we can bring them all into context in some of the challenges that we experience today. As we know, the internet brings with it all kinds of fascinating, wonderful bounty, all kinds of tremendous boons to our productivity and to our ability to learn and to communicate. And I think it's taken as a given that any time that you talk about the challenges and the risks of the internet, you have to first mention how much you love the internet. So I can certainly subscribe to that. Very devoted consumer of the benefits of the internet. At the same time, in order to be a consumer, so we have to also be cognizant of what some of the issues are. And of course, there are issues in many areas of religion and morality, many issues of halacha and hashgacha. But the one that we're focusing on today is the realm of Lashon Hara and how that realm is affected by our behavior on the internet. Lashon Hara, of course, is a meta theme within the Torah. It's something that many of the mitzvot HaTorah, many of the events in the Torah address. Most recently in Parshas Mishpatim that we read a week and a half ago, we read 8 days ago, so the pasuk of Lo Siso Shem Ashav, which the question how to translate that, maybe we'll have opportunity to talk about it in a few minutes. The Talmud tells us that is also relevant to the prohibition of receiving Lashon Hara, and perhaps also to the prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara. So in the wake of Parshas Mishpatim, that we're just a little bit removed from, it also gives us some context to talk about the concepts of Lashon Hara in this realm. So, first of all, to talk about the positive component, so we know that there is much to be gained from public discussion. Sometimes there are things that need to be exposed, things that need to be brought to light, and that's not a question, that's not an issue that there are such things that exist, and that the internet can play a crucial and vital role in making that happen. The question is, how do we guarantee, or how do we at least strive, to that make that happen in a context that's appropriate from a halachic and philosophical point of view. We know that there is such a concept as Lashon Hara L'Toeles, which means that if you're speaking for a vital, constructive purpose, so then Lashon Hara is not only permissible, but is often required. But in order to know how to apply that, so we need to have somewhat of a framework, somewhat of an understanding of how this body of law develops. It's interesting, there is a discussion in some of the later literature, drawing on the earlier literature. It could be that it's almost explicit in the writings of Rabbeinu Yonah, and a little less so in the writings of the Rambam. A question of what exactly is the focus when we talk about a prohibition of Lashon Hara? What exactly is the issue? Because on the one hand, we could look at it as a midos issue, as a character trait concern, that for a person to be a gossip, somebody who likes to speak negatively about others, who likes to indulge in that kind of conversation, that's considered to be a poor midah, that's considered to be a unworthy character trait, and that's one issue. While others focus not so much on the character trait, but on the result, on the idea that you're hurting someone through speech, that it's a gram hezek, it's a causational damage, that you could cause somebody serious problems, unwarranted or beyond what is warranted, by speaking about them in a undeservedly negative light, which doesn't exclude things that are true. Things can be true and still undeservedly negative. And therefore, that's a concern, the concern that you will cause harm to other people. So those two areas of focus, whether it's a character trait or whether it's a concern of actually hurting people through talking about them, so that's important background when we consider the question of how do we look at the permission and the obligation that comes with toelas. The idea that sometimes it's required for you to say something because it's a purposeful, it's a toelis. So how do we understand that? So if we're focusing on the character trait concern, on the fact that it's bad to be a gossip, to talk for no reason about people, so then it might be suggested that if you have a valuable reason, if you have an important toelis, so then that's not gossip, that's simply not the definition of the character trait of Lashon Hara that we're talking about. That's one way to approach things, and that's a broader way, because that will allow for a broader license, that as long as your motive is something less than gossip, is something more than gossip, rather something more reasonably and more necessary in terms of your motivation, then that will put it in a different category. However, there's another way to look at it also, that if we focus on the harm that you cause to somebody by speaking about them, so if you're going to talk about somebody who's being considered for a job, who's being considered for a shidduch, and is not going to get the job of the shidduch because you say what has to be said about them necessarily, so is that causing them harm? For sure. So why is it permitted? It's permitted and it's required because we have a conflict between two goals. On the one hand, not hurting the person who we're speaking about, but on the other hand, there's also a mitzvah of lo samor al dam re'echa, that we can't stand by when there's an innocent victim who is at risk, when somebody could be hurt by another person, and therefore that obligates us to speak. So we have a clash between these two ideas. On the one hand, protecting the person who we're speaking about, but on the other hand, the often more important goal of protecting a potentially innocent victim. So therefore, the imperative of lo samor al dam re'echa overrides the prohibition of Lashon Hara in that context. And it's very instructive that the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, they're both together in the same Pasuk. The Torah tells us, Lo Seilech Rachil Bi'amecha, that we don't want to walk around talking about people, but at the same time, Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, if necessary, we're going to have to say what has to be said. So the fact that they're in the same Pasuk over there perhaps illustrates that idea that is sometimes a balance and a trade-off. So these two different perspectives, whether it's a question of shifting the midah that's involved, it's just simply an issue of taking it out of the category of unnecessary gossip, or is it a trade-off between these two clashing concerns, not hurting the person who you're speaking about and not allowing somebody else to be hurt by that person? So that gives us some type of a context to consider how do we weigh the issues, how do we balance the different things that are in front of us when we make a decision to speak or not to speak. And in that spirit, there were many conditions that were considered. The Chafetz Chaim, for example, has 7 conditions he feels are necessary in order to justify Lashon Hara l'toeles. It was somewhat controversial. Not everyone agreed that all 7 of those conditions were necessary. The Chazon Ish, for example, thought it was only one condition, that you have to intend l'toeles, you have to have a purposeful reason. And others thought somewhere in the middle. Some boiled it down to 3 different imperatives, based on the Chafetz Chaim and regrouping some of them, that perhaps the concern is that you should be accurate, you shouldn't say anything that's not true, or possibly not true, that there be no other way to accomplish the goal that you're trying to accomplish, and that you should have intent to do that and only that, or at least primarily that. For example, there is a fascinating Dvar Torah that was suggested by the Afikayam. Afikayam, I believe, is a student of Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. So in the introduction to one of his svarim, so he comments on the psukim in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, where the Torah tells us that Yosef apparently seemed to be speaking Lashon Hara about his brothers. The Torah tells us, Ve'aveh Yosef as dibasam ra el avihem, that Yosef was speaking badly about his brothers. And there's a difference of opinion among the commentaries whether he was justified or not in what he was doing. So the Afikayam assumes Yosef HaTzadik was presumably justified. He was speaking Lashon Hara l'toeles. He was speaking for an important purpose in order that his father should correct the behavior of the brothers. So the Afikayam comments on various phrases in the pasuk over there that are unusual. He explains that each one is coming to teach us one of the rules of toeles. It says, first of all, the first rule in his understanding is that you have no other way to accomplish what has to be done here, that this is the only way you can do it, and therefore it justifies such an attack. So that, how do we see that in the pasuk? Because one could have said that if Yosef had problems with his brother's behavior, so then he should have spoken to them directly. He should have tried to deal with them one-on-one instead of going to somebody else. says, for that reason, the pasuk emphasizes that for Hunar Espinay Bilhavi Espinay Zilpa, that he was a kid compared to them. They didn't take him seriously. He wasn't going to have any effect on them if he would try to talk to them. So that wasn't an option. It says, then the pasuk goes on to say, Vayavei Yosef es dibasam ra, that Yosef brought their bad report. That's a funny language. There are so many words in Hebrew for speaking. You can say v'yaged, v'yomar, v'yedaber. Why is it that the Torah says he brought the bad reports? So the Afikayam says it's because it's trying to convey another requirement, that there has to be complete accuracy without any editorializing. That he doesn't put any spin on it. It's like he's carrying an object. If you take an object from one place to another, presumably it's the same object when you pick it up and when you put it down. So too, when he brought the facts to his father, it was the identical facts when he picked them up and when he put them down. He didn't change them at all with any kind of spin, with any kind of editorializing. So that was the second consideration that he derived from the pasuk. And the last consideration, he noted that the pasuk says he brought the report El Avihem to their father. So Yaakov was the father of the brothers. Why doesn't the pasuk say El Aviv? Wasn't Yaakov his father also? You can imagine if two brothers are having a fight and one brother says, I'm going to tell your father on you. See, I'm going to tell daddy on you. I'm going to tell our father. I'm going to tell your father. So the Afikayam suggests that that also represents a condition, that the Torah is trying to emphasize that Yosef didn't have any ulterior motive. He could have thought that, okay, I'll make my brothers look bad, and I'll score points that my father will like me better because I'm making my brothers look worse by contrast. So the Torah is emphasizing that he wasn't thinking about that at all, that the fact that he was his father didn't occur to him, wasn't something he was thinking about. The only reason he was talking to him is because he was their father, because he was a person in charge of controlling their behavior. So that was all that came to his mind. Afikayam says that's the third condition. All these conditions derived from this pasuk. It's a fascinating idea. So however you understand it, whether you understand it like the Chafetz Chaim, that there are seven conditions, whether you understand it like the Chazon Ish, that it's more limited, whether you see it somewhere in the middle, it's clear that there is a tremendous burden of responsibility when one decides to speak in this context, to make sure that he's speaking accurately, that he's speaking necessarily, that he's speaking with the proper motives, that all of that be the proper context for making a decision to speak in that way. Then when we consider how things play out on the internet specifically, which is a whole different realm, which is a method of communication, which has a different kind of impact than ever has been before, so it pushes us to consider a few other fascinating details that we find in the Talmud regarding the laws of Lashon Hara. And it's interesting specifically how this impacts the modern context of internet communication. There are two statements in the Talmud, in Maseches Erechin. Maseches Erechin is a page in the middle which has many of the statements about how Lashon Hara is applied and regulated. And the Talmud there has two statements which are very surprising. And your logic would push you in a different direction. Your instinct would be that this is not correct. And the Chafetz Chaim, in fact, in his ruling, says, like you would think, says the opposite of these statements in the Talmud. So we have to figure out what do these statements mean, and what can they teach us in our modern context. The Talmud says two rules. One rule is that anything that's said in front of three, it's called ape tflasa, which is a way of saying in public, because three people, the whole world knows if three people know, because a friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a cousin who has a brother who has an uncle who has a barber, who has a neighbor who has a dog walker who knows somebody else. So essentially, if three people know, the whole world knows. Anything that's said in front of three, says the Talmud, is not subject to the laws of Lashon Hara. So we have to figure out what that means, because on the surface, it's very surprising. One would think that if it's bad to speak to one person, so all the more so, it's much worse to speak to many people. So how exactly that's to be understood is a topic of major debate among the Rishonim. The Chafetz Chaim rules the way we would think. The Chafetz Chaim says that it's bad to speak Lashon Hara to one person, and it's much worse to speak to many people. It's multiplied exponentially by the more people who you speak to, which widen the net of the damage. So we have to figure out, what does the Talmud mean when it says there's some type of permission if it's in front of three? The second very surprising statement in the Talmud, and we'll look at the two together, is the Talmud says that anything that's said ape mara, which means in front of the subject, the person you're speaking about, if he's there, so then again there's no prohibition of Lashon Hara. And again, that's astounding. I would think it's bad enough to speak badly about somebody, But if he has to be there to hear it, it's going to hurt him even more. He's going to have to be embarrassed. It's certainly a compounded transgression to speak in front of the person. So, and once again, what does the Chafetz Chaim say if you look at his ruling? He says to speak about a person behind his back is bad, and to speak about him in his presence is much worse. As we would have thought, you're adding on an additional component that you're embarrassing him at the same time. So what do these two statements in the Talmud mean? How do we understand these two counterintuitive and counterfactual statements in terms of how they're ruled? We'll see how it... So we'll see, it's a big debate, Rishon, we'll see if this addresses what you're about to ask. So when it comes to the first statement of in front of three, of Ape Tlasa, so there are at least four perspectives in the Rishon, which you'll see it'll follow along lines of what you're suggesting. And in this case, it's not clear which of the four are right. And the Chafetz Chaim suggests taking into consideration all four. Now, I'd like to suggest that he's not saying that simply as a chumrah. He's not saying simply, okay, because this is a matter of rabbinical law, let's take into account, a matter of biblical law, let's take into account all the opinions. I don't think it's simply that. But I think what he's saying is that each one of these views reflects a reality about human nature. And therefore, we have to take into consideration all of the four views when we try to figure out how to apply this somewhat mysterious statement. So the four views of how to understand the Ape Tzlasa idea, the in front of three idea. So the first two views assume that it's talking about the listener. That the listener heard something said in public, that's what the Rashi is suggesting, and therefore it should be permissible for him to repeat it afterwards. That essentially it was already made public by somebody else, and therefore there's no additional prohibition for him to repeat it after he's already heard it. That's the view of the Rashbam in his commentary to Bava Basra, where we find the statement as well. And it seems to be that it's the view of the Rambam. It seems to be that it's the opinion of Maimonides. So according to that view, it would seem to follow that if you've heard something said in public, so then it's permitted to repeat it, because it's already in public, already you're not going to do any more damage by saying it again. Now that's subject to many questions and restrictions, even if that is the correct view. First of all, it's still possible that by your repeating it, you're going to hasten the process of this information getting out there. So yes, it's true that because so many people heard it, it's going to spread, but why does that allow you to spread it or to spread it faster? One could argue that's like saying, if somebody leaves his property unguarded, so since it's likely to be stolen, so it's okay for you to steal it, because it's likely it's going to get stolen soon anyway. So we wouldn't assume that. So too, we probably wouldn't assume that it's okay for you to hasten the process. So that's true, and that's why it's important to note that the Rambam, for example, the Rambam, when he says a similar statement, he says that you have to have intent not to spread the information further. That you can talk about something that's already out there, but provided you don't have intent to be spreading it. You're not expanding the net, you're just conversing the topic among the crowd of people who already know about it. So why does he say that condition? That condition is not in the Talmud. So some understand it's because of this concern that we just mentioned, because you can discuss it where it's already known, but you can't cause it to be spread intentionally. You can't look to expand the circle of people who know about it. Others suggest that the Rambam himself seems to imply a whole different issue. As we mentioned before, there are two different considerations. One is that you shouldn't hurt people through talking about them. The other is that you shouldn't be a nasty gossip. So the Rambam is concerned about both of them. So he says, if you're not going to hurt people anymore because it's already well known, that's okay to discuss because you're not damaging them. But you still, even within that context, you can't have nasty intent. If you're trying to disparage the person, even if you're not adding to the circle of information, that's still a character issue, that's still a Midos problem, and that could be also what the Rambam is suggesting. That's how many of the later Sfarim understood the Rambam. So it could be that's the understanding within, let's say, the Rashbam and the Rambam, that something that's already public could be repeated, but again, under very limited conditions and under controlled circumstances with a lot of care and sensitivity. There is another view that's similar to this, but very different in terms of what it would allow for, Rashi, in his commentary to Erchim, Rashi says it also refers to the listeners, but for a different reason. Not because it's already out there, because he seems to suggest that that still would not permit you to continue perpetuating the gossip. But, says Rashi, the issue is that if I, for example, as the speaker, say something in front of many people, so then the crowd can assume if I said it in public, I don't mind if you repeat it. I don't intend it to be private because I said it in front of so many people. Now, if that's the understanding, it only applies to a very limited scope of material. It only applies to things that I have the permission to say and to give you permission to repeat. If I got up here and said something negative about somebody that I didn't have the right to say, so that would not at all give you more of a right to repeat it. It would only give you the right to repeat things that I allowed to say in the first place and to give you permission to repeat. So it only refers to a very narrow category of material, something that I'm in control of, my personal information, for example. So if I say in public, you can assume I don't think it's confidential. I don't necessarily require that you should be quiet about it. But anything that's outside of that very narrow scope wouldn't even be included in this permission. So that's in terms of the two views that understand this as referring to the listener. Now there are two views in Rishonim that see it as speaking to the speaker. That the speaker somehow is more justified if he's speaking to more people. And that's what we started off by saying, it's very hard to understand. If it's bad to speak to one person, it's worse to speak to many people. Why should it be permissible to speak to a larger crowd rather than to one person? So the two ways of taking that view, one is Rabbeinu Yonah, we'll mention him first. And the more interesting one for our purposes is the one after that. Rabbeinu Yonah understands that it's because we're assuming you're saying something for a purpose. You're saying something because you want it to make a difference. So if you want it to make a difference, you have to say it in a way that's going to make a difference. If you're just going to whisper it to your friend in a corner in a way that it's not going to get back to the person who you're speaking about, it's not going to change his behavior, it's not going to have any impact, then that goes back to being plain gossip. It's only purposeful if it's going to be effective. So therefore, that's how Rabbeinu Yonah understood it would have to be in a context where it's clear you're serious and you're trying to make a difference. But what's more interesting for us in the context of the internet is the view of Tosfos. Tosfos, in his commentary to Baba Basra and in the commentary to Erechin, has an explanation which links these two mysterious statements. The statement of speaking in front of three, and speaking in front of the person, which we said was also so surprising. Why should that be okay? So Tosfos explained that both of those share a common purpose. What's going on there? That we're not talking about somebody who's getting up and disparaging people, somebody who's getting up and saying nasty things. We're talking about somebody who's saying something which could be interpreted two ways. Could be interpreted positively and could be interpreted negatively. But the speaker, he means it positively. However, maybe we should be concerned that the crowd, these people who he's speaking to, the listener, let's say, is not going to understand it that way. The listener will understand it in a negative way. So the speaker should be worried about that. So the Talmud says there are certain settings where we can assume that the person has positive intent. That if the person speaks in public, or if the person speaks in the person's presence, so then we can assume that they mean it in the positive way. So let's say, for example, I were to tell you in private, oh, that Joe, you can always count on him. So you might not know what I mean. You might think I mean that you can always rely on him, or you can always count on him to mess up. You can always count on him to cause a problem. So you don't know what interpretation I'm trying to say. But if I get up at the shul dinner and I say in front of 100 people, Joe, you can always count on him. Or if I say when he's right there, there's Joe, you can always count on him. So then you know that I presumably mean the positive interpretation. So in the view of Tosfos, what is going on? The context that we're saying here is what makes it permissible. That because we have this context of a public setting, or the person being present, and we assume that a decent person presumably will only speak decently about somebody in front of people, many people, or in that person's presence. So therefore, that contributes to an environment where the conversation will stay appropriate, where, well, what is said is going to be acceptable. It's very interesting when you look at some of the other discussions also about this question of speaking in the person's presence, because again, it seems to be such a strange idea. We normally would assume that that would be worse. If you're going to speak about somebody in their presence, you're going to cause them embarrassment. That's a separate prohibition. That's something that's also a very serious issue on the internet often, that people cause pain and emotional suffering to people without thinking about it because they are separated from it, something we'll talk about in a few minutes. So if the person's there, shouldn't that make it worse? So it's interesting. That is the view of the Chafetz Chaim and others, that indeed that's the case. That makes it worse. There was a minority view. There were a handful of Rishonim and Achronim who did take the statement of the Talmud on its surface level and say that yes, there is a mitigation, there is some reduction in the Isser of Lashon Hara if you're in the person's presence. For example, there was the Sefer Yireyim. The Sefer Yireyim understood that the issue of speaking about somebody in their presence versus not in their presence, since he noted that we call Lashon Hara Rechilus, tail-bearing. And the verse says in the book of Yirmiyahu, Holchei Rachel Nechoshes U'Barzel, that those who speak, those who go around talking about people, they are like copper and iron. So what does that mean? So the Sefer Yireyim understands that it means that they're two-faced, that sometimes they appear as copper, which is all nice and shiny, and then other times they appear as barzel, which is what you make weapons out of, what you use to hurt people. So the issue with Lashon Hara and the understanding of the Yireyim, it's a unique understanding, it's that you present one face to them when you're with them, you seem like you're all friendly, and then when they're not there, so then you're nasty, then you stab them in the back, so to speak. So that's the prime issue of Rechilus, the way he understands it. So if that's the concern, saying, so when you're in the person's presence, so then it may be something else, it may be onas devarim, it may be emotional pain, that's the problem, but it's not the same prohibition as Lashon Hara. It's a fascinating idea. Again, how much it impacts halacha is questionable, but it gives us a little bit of a perspective, another angle in what's going on. There also was a comment of the Maharal of Prague, in his Sefer, Sivas Olam, and the Maharal suggests a very mysterious statement, which was the topic of a lot of discussion, his later adherents, that the Maharal writes that the nature of the prohibition of speaking, speaking badly about people, is that you use this tool of speech, which is a remote tool, to hurt them. That normally if you want to hurt somebody, so you have to punch them in the nose, you have to throw something at them, you have to kick them, you have to deal with them head on. And speech is a way of attacking somebody from the side. So attacking somebody when they're not there. So says the Maharal, that's the whole nature of the misuse of speech that represents Lashon Hara. So when you're in the person's presence, so that's a direct confrontation that could involve other problems, but that's already not Lashon Hara. He also throws in there the fact that the person can respond if you're in their presence, so then that also shifts things. That's a significant issue that also comes into play. Okay, so that's, again, somewhat of a perspective on what that statement in the Talmud might mean, but at the end of the day, so the Chafetz Chaim and most other halachic authorities assume that if you speak in a person's presence, so then not only are you in violation of onas devarim, of hurting their feelings and the like, but that's a violation of Lashon Hara as well. So if we put all that together, if we think about it, so what exactly is happening here? So here we have a situation where it's bad to speak badly about people. It's worse, certainly, intuitively and actually, if you do it in front of many people or if you do it in their presence. There are statements in the Talmud that those contexts make it okay because those contexts will allow for a more controlled environment, will create a situation where the damage will be controlled or limited or not actually there at all. Now we plug that in, no pun intended, to a modern context. So when somebody is disparaging somebody else on the internet, so we have on the one hand all the chumras of the situation, all the reasons to think it's bad, that certainly applies. Not only is it ape tzvasa, it's not in front of three, it's ape zillion, it's in front of everybody, it's the world wide web, it's there to the most people forever. And it's likely to be Ape Mara also. The person who is being spoken about will read it, will likely see it, and has all those severities, but without any of the mitigating factors. None of the reasons why it's better are present. The person is not going to feel controlled or inhibited. And in fact, just the opposite. There is a very real scenario which has been documented called the online disinhibition effect. The idea that somebody from the comfort of his computer screen feels a greater level of disconnection from the consequences of what he's saying or how he's saying it. So therefore we have all of the severity of these issues without any of the mitigating factors. And that's before we get to the issue of anonymity. Once you have anonymity, so that was already a concern that the philosophers already from the day of Plato. Plato wrote about a ring, a magical ring, Gaija's ring, that would give somebody invisibility. And he said if a person was shielded from all types of consequences, because people couldn't see what he was doing, how much could we expect that he would behave properly, that he would be a righteous person? So certainly in this context, if we assume there are any issues when it comes to speech, and we provide anonymity, so that anonymity becomes a tremendous concern, and that together with the online disinhibition effect, which doesn't even require anonymity, but together with anonymity, one can only imagine the level of concern, the level of problem that's being created. We throw in a few other factors, we throw in a few other issues. So for example, on the internet, so very often the person who's writing, so maybe what he's writing is appropriate, but there's also a comment section. And the comment section invites the whole world to come and say whatever they want. So that's a very serious consideration as well, because even if what you're saying is appropriate and okay, if you're giving a forum for others to say something that's not appropriate, so then the Talmud addresses that already as well. The Talmud tells us that there is a concept called avak lashon hara. Avak lashon hara we could translate as second degree lashon hara. That if you're giving a person reason, if you're provoking somebody to say something, so many Rishonim understand that's what's called avak lashon hara, the second degree concept. And it seems to be pretty explicit in the Talmud. The Talmud says that it's not only a problem to speak badly about somebody, it could be a problem to speak well about somebody. That if you speak about somebody in a positive tone, but you're speaking in front of his enemies, so his enemies are going to say, oh, you think he's so great, let me tell you why he's not so great, let me tell you all the problems, I could argue on everything you're saying. So if you're going to provoke that kind of a statement, sounds like from the Talmud that you have responsibility for that, that there's a liability involved in provoking people to speak badly, even if you yourself are not speaking badly. So that's a serious concern, that certainly if you're providing an unmoderated forum for people to say whatever they want, so then it sounds like from the Talmud there's a direct liability for that. That's what's called the avak lashon hara. That again also becomes a very serious concern. It's also a concern in terms of Kabbalah Lashon Hara, which we'll speak more about in a minute. But the idea of Kabbalah Lashon Hara, of accepting Lashon Hara, so that's also an issue for the speaker. That the speaker, even when he has a justification for what he's saying, Chafetz Chaim and others tell us that there's a requirement to be careful in how it's received. That if you know it's going to be received in the wrong way, or it's going to be taken as more than it is, so then that also creates a problem. That also creates an issue for the speaker. So when it comes to, for example, you have a site that aggregates news articles, let's say. So when it comes to something that's in the newspaper, so then one could argue that it might be that it's permissible to discuss what's in the newspaper, either because maybe it's for an important purpose, maybe whatever in the news is important, that's an issue of toelas. It could also be that it's already a new level of public knowledge. That many of the poskim, including possibly the Chafetz Chaim, said there was a category beyond Ape Tzlasa, that not just, we mentioned before, about three people will eventually spread, but there's a category maybe called Mefursim Lakol, that if really the whole world knows, if it's really, really out there, there's not anybody around who doesn't know this already, so then it could be that that's already not subject to the basic prohibition of Lashon Hara. Again, assuming that all the character issues, the midos concerns are properly addressed, that you're still trying to avoid unnecessary gossip and negativity and unfairness, then in theory there could be permission for that. So in that setting, there's what to talk about. But still, when it comes to how the newspaper articles are presented, so there's still a concern, because it's very possible that the readers misunderstand it. So very often when you have a site that's going to aggregate newspaper articles that has a comment section, so if you look at the comment section, you can see that people aren't even properly understanding the article. So they're taking what's being written and taking it to another level, which introduces a whole new degree of negativity, and that's also a serious concern. There was a sefer that came out this year on the laws of Lashon Hara. So it discusses this prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. And he writes there that if somebody says to you that it says such and such in a newspaper, so it's permissible to believe him that it's in a newspaper. Not necessarily to believe that newspaper got it right. Very often newspapers get it wrong. But at least the fact that it's there in the newspaper, you can believe the person is telling the truth about that, because it's what we call in halacha a milsa da'avidi l'gluyei, that it's something that will be revealed. A person is not going to lie about that, because you can just look in the newspaper yourself and you can see that he's making it up. So that's how this sefer suggested, so therefore that should have credibility. It's questionable whether that's true or not, because it's not the assumption that a person is going to make it up, is going to say something in the newspaper that's not there. But very often people don't understand what it said in the paper. They read it quickly, they see a headline, and they don't read the whole story. The headline sometimes summarizes things in too quick of a fashion. And if you look at the comments on some of these sites, you see that they didn't really understand what was being said. You see that there's a whole new level of negativity that's being added, and that's also a very serious concern. So when we put all of that into the mix, so there are a lot of risks. On the one hand, there is the appropriate need to discuss important issues, to save others from harm in all types of forms, to be able to make a difference in terms of losamot al dam reacha and other positive improvements to society. But on the other hand, when the conditions aren't being met, when something is inaccurate, when unfairly negative and the like, so then we bear all types of other levels of responsibility that weren't there before. A greater level of exposure than ever could have been imagined in the past, a greater level of direct infliction of pain, which is a separate problem. Even people who aren't trying to disparage, is often the issue of anas dvarim, of causing emotional pain. You can see how people are disconnected from it when it comes on comments on the internet. So for example, if Rahman al-Islan, a tragedy happens, not necessarily in terms of disparaging anybody, but there are comments that are made that the people making the comments would never say directly to the family. They wouldn't go to a shiva house and say the kind of things that they're saying in these comments. But it's very likely that the family members are going to see these comments, and that isn't occurring to the people who are writing them, because there's such a feeling of separation. The same thing they would never dream of saying face to face, they are essentially saying face to face because of this level of disconnect, and that becomes a very serious consideration. So all of these things have to be taken into the balance in one way. On the one hand, there are important things that have to be said. There are points that have to be conveyed. And at the same time, there's a tremendous risk that comes from the Ape Tlasa component, that comes from the Ape Mara component, that comes from the Avak Lashon Hara component, that comes from everything else that is multiplied and intensified by the internet context. Hi. Moderation makes a big difference. The question is who's doing the moderation. The moderation should be somebody who knows what he's doing, and should be frequent enough. But definitely, you know, there are responsible sites. There are people who do moderate carefully. But that also is a tremendous responsibility to take on one's shoulders to make sure that that's being done properly. But there's no question that's a major step. You know, when we talk about this subject, the first thing we said is, you know, well, I love the internet. We all love the internet. That we're in a community that's not going to ban the internet. We're going to keep using the internet and benefiting from all the wonderful things that we can gain from it. So the question is, how do we do that in a proper context? So one way is to try to understand all of these issues and to therefore weigh them properly so that the usage is understood. And those of us who are providing content to do what we can to make sure that that content is as fair and appropriate as possible, which certainly includes moderation and the like. And from the consumer's perspective, so most of what we've said so far is really addressed to those who provide content, those who are writing on the internet. But what about those who are listening, those who are reading in this case? So there's a whole different level of focus. Now when it comes to what we call Kabbalah Lashon Hara, so that's a serious concern. And that's something which requires some attention as well. It's fascinating. We mentioned at the beginning that a week and a half ago, so we read last previous Shabbos, we read Parshas Mishpatim. And Parashas Mishpatim, so the Torah tells us, Lo Sisa Hashem Shav, that one should not accept a report that is Shav. It's interesting, it's a question how to translate the word Shav. The Talmud says in Maseches Pesachim, if he was learning Pesachim this year, that this is a source for the prohibition of accepting Lashon Hara. So apparently Shav refers to something in the category of Lashon Hara. Rashi and Unkelos say that the word means Sheker. It means things that are false. So how does that match with our understanding that Lashon Hara means even things that are true? So if the Pasuk that tells us not to be Mekabel Lashon Hara means, is the verse essentially says, don't accept things that are false. So how does that come together? So there are a few different ways to understand it. Some translate Shav differently. But those who translate Shav as meaning Sheker, so some understand the way Rabbeinu Yonah understands, that it means one shouldn't accept a Safek Sheker, something that might be false. Which, as later Svarim point out, that makes the most sense, because if you know it's false, so why would you accept something that you know is false? So maybe it means that something that might be false, don't take it as true if it could be false. If there's something that you have to question about it, so then you have an obligation to do that, to be skeptical. And beyond that, that even if the facts are true, but it creates a false picture, it creates an overall image that ends up being false, so it's your obligation not to let that happen. So that's a big discussion what that means in practice. There is a whole debate as to what the prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara means. The Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer, it sounds like he understands that the prohibition means that you shouldn't believe it, essentially, that you shouldn't allow it to enter your consciousness, whether that means questioning its accuracy when that's reasonable, or that means taking it into a different type of perspective and a different framework. But he understands that it's a function of what you're thinking, what your attitude is towards the person. And others, such as Rav Moshe Shterbach, a contemporary posek who lives in Yerushalayim, those Chuvis and Hagos, so he says that he doesn't think that that's reasonable. He says that Torah lo nitna l'malachei hasharis, the Torah is given to human beings, so we can't control what we're thinking, we can't control what we believe. If somebody who I trust tells me something, so I'll presumably believe him. I'm presumably going to think that that's true. So what does it mean when I have to not be mekabel? So Sternbach understands that it means that outside of what's necessary to protect myself, outside of something that is the toeles, I have to try to make sure that I don't treat the person any differently. So if somebody tells me something bad about my coworker, so I'm not going to start snubbing him, I'm not going to stop sitting with him in the cafeteria, I'll still say good morning to him, I'll still treat him the same way, even if I believe what I was told, and even if I have to protect myself in other ways and protect others in other ways, I still won't let it go beyond that. So that's how Rav Sternbach understands that it's about practical effects on the person. Everyone agrees that Kabbalah Lashon Hara is not the same as hearing. That when we're told you're not allowed to accept, it doesn't mean you're not allowed to hear. The question is, what does it mean beyond hearing? Does it mean assimilating it into your consciousness, like the Chafetz Chaim? Or does it mean treating the person differently because of what you've heard? So what does that mean about hearing? Does that mean that it's completely permissible to hear and to read anything as long as you're careful about how you assimilate it, how you're careful about how you integrate it? So the Chafetz Chaim thought for sure that was not the case. The Chafetz Chaim said there is a prohibition of listening, it's a different prohibition. It's understandable because it will clearly be very short jump from there to accepting, but on its own scope, he says, is a prohibition of listening. However, the prohibition of listening has many more exceptions. For example, you don't know what's going to be the toela. Sometimes you have to listen because there's a strong possibility it's going to make a difference in your life, so you have to be open to that. There are other reasons to listen also. Sometimes you listen because you can provide a therapeutic benefit to the person speaking. That's something that even the Chafetz Chaim acknowledged and that earlier sources spoke about, that sometimes the person needs to be able to speak and you need to be able to listen. That's what the Talmud says in the 8th Parak of Yuma, quoting a pasuk, Daiga Belevish Yashchen, a person has worry in his heart, he should get rid of it. How should he get rid of it? So the Talmud says, Yisichana la'acherim, he should talk about it to other people. So the Chafetz Chaim says, apparently that's also considered to be l'toelas, when it's done in an appropriate and productive fashion, to speak to somebody about what's happening with you and have them listen, perhaps provide advice, perhaps not, but even just the act of listening might be consequentially beneficial in that case. So there are circumstances where it's appropriate to listen. And the Rosh Dermbach has a tshuva where he emphasizes and says, for sure, if a person is in a position of authority, if a person is a rabbi of a community or the head of a school or some other position where he's responsible for people, so then, says Rosh Dermbach, he quoted from Reb Chaim Ozer Brzezinski, said that it's the obligation that he listens to what's being said. He has to know what's out there so he's aware of any potential issues that he has to address. There are times when there's really going to be a necessity to listen, but under those circumstances, then it becomes all the more important to develop the difference between listening and accepting, to be able to listen with a critical ear, and to not necessarily make that short leap from there to accepting, to assimilating it into your consciousness in a way that might be unjustified. And that's a major issue, particularly now. There's a fascinating book that recently came out, it's called Blur. Written by somebody named Rosenstiel and somebody else, I forgot the other author's name, who talks about how to figure out what's true in terms of the whole mass of information that's on the internet, everything coming from so many different directions. So he talks about there the way of skeptical knowing. He talks about what type of questions one has to ask when he sees a piece of information coming, what types of issues have to be raised in terms of who's writing this, how is it being written, what's the whole goal. He talks about how there are different forms of journalism today, that not all journalism is meant to inform. Some journalism, as he writes, is meant to assert, is all coming within a certain context of a pre-established view, and one has to know when he's reading what is the premise of what he's reading, what's the context of what he's reading, and take it all into that consideration. He also pointed out it was something that was relevant already to the 24-hour cable news environment, but all the more so it's relevant to the internet, is that it used to be that when you have journalism, so information was processed and analyzed and sifted, and then presented to the public. Now, because first of the speed of the 24-hour news cycle, but all the more so with the intensity of internet communication and blogs and the like, so as they put it, the raw ingredients of journalism are being presented as journalism. That which goes into the process is being transmitted to the public right away without going through that whole filtering process. And that puts a greater obligation on the consumer to know what it is that they're taking in and to know how to interpret that, and all of that becomes a part of the responsibility if we are going to responsibly and appropriately interact with this medium. We just have a few minutes left, so I put on the sign that we talk also about Purgspiels in the spirit of others, so just to mention how it connects to that. So it's interesting, so when we talk about Spiels have always been controversial and yet have been around for a long time. Full disclosure here in YU, we certainly do have a spiel, which I have some involvement in. And as Rav Schechter has pointed out in the past, that this yeshiva was founded by people who came from the yeshiva in Volozhin. So many of the practices carried over from Volozhin. I don't know if that's the exact source of how the spiel started, but it's interesting to note that it's written that in the Volozhin yeshiva, so they had a spiel, there's much written about that. And it says that one time, the best student in Volozhin, whose name was Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, did a perfect imitation of the Netziv. Sounds very much like the modern spiels that we're familiar with. And that was accepted at that time. And then, many decades later, when he became Rav Cook, so he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Amerikas HaRav, and the Netziv's great-grandson was a student in the yeshiva, and he did a perfect imitation of Rav Cook. So Rav Cook said, okay, I got paid back, that's the cycle, and that was considered accepted there. At the same time, there were many poskim who wrote and printed shuvas, so Rav Aji Yosef, Rav Pam has an essay about this, Rav Sternbach wrote about this, Yosef Fidushinsky wrote about this. There were many printed shuvas that were very opposed to Purim Spiels for reasons that we can understand. We can understand certainly the risk of potentially embarrassing people, of speaking badly about people, of a lack of Kavod HaTorah. We're talking about the Rebbeim and the like that could come about, so it's not hard to guess what the potential problems are. So the question is, when we're aware of all of that, so how do we look at that from a perspective of what we've been speaking about, and how do we mitigate that? So first off, do we assume that if we're just joking around, if it's a schok, if it's a joke, so then it's permissible? So our bad luck is that no, the Rambam writes that's for sure not permissible, and the Chafetz Chaim, perhaps not coincidentally, when he talks about what we've been talking about till now, when he talks about speaking in someone's presence, this whole idea of Ape Mara, so in that same section, he goes on to talk about Derech Schok. So it sounds like he's already addressing the Purim Spiel. So you have somebody who's there with you in the room, and you're joking around, is that permissible? So he says, not permissible at all. It sounds like from the Rambam that it's an issue of avak lashon hara, that it's a second degree, it's not actual lashon hara. And it sounds like from the Chafetz Chaim that it is absolute lashon hara. So then if that's the case, then we have a big problem. So then why should we have this practice of having a perm spiel? Why is it accepted and taken as it is here and elsewhere? So another avenue to pursue is the question is, do we assume on Purim there is Mechila? That's an idea that you find in the Rishonim, that Purim itself or other comparable events create an environment where everyone participates, so to speak, at their own risk. They know what's going to happen going in, and you find this already. The Rishonim talk about this in the context of minor property damage or minor theft, that there were certain things that were done during Purim celebrations or other celebrations where people would grab other people's stuff or people would damage other people's property in minor ways, and it was assumed that people are mochel, that they want to have a good time on Purim. They know that you can't have a fun Purim party if everyone's going to be so worried if they get a drop of wine on the carpet. So therefore, certain minor things, there's an attitude of mechila where otherwise it wouldn't be the case, but in this context, everyone knows going in that they buy into that. So does that play a role here? That in the spiel, could we assume that mechila makes a difference? Maybe. To some degree, yes. But that's assuming that you're not actually hurting the person. If you're actually causing the person physical or emotional suffering, so then the postman will explain that's called sarah degufa, that's called emotional pain, and that's not given to mechila. You can be mochel on monetary issues. You owe me money because you dropped the wine on my carpet. I could be mochel on that. You grabbed my stuff, I could be mochel on that. But you caused me emotional suffering. So it's not clear that mechila applies to that, which would mean that even if a person had previously said it's okay, it doesn't let you off the hook once you're doing it. It doesn't at all mitigate the prohibition. So on the one hand, a person's mechila seems to help in the spirit of things, but on the other hand, from the halachic perspective, we have to figure out how far it goes in terms of actually mitigating what's going on. So what seems to really be the key factor, which seems to really be the issue that makes it permissible when it's done appropriately, is more in the view of Tosfos. Like we said before, we talked about Tosfos' interpretation of Ape Mara and Ape Tzlasa, that the context gives it a certain picture and a certain perspective. So hopefully that's true when it comes to Purim. That the context of the environment and the Purim spiel, and if it's done with a good heart, if it's done in an environment where everybody's friendly and everybody's comfortable with each other, so then it's clear that there is no genuine negativity that's intended by anything that's going on. That's all assuming that that's the case, assuming that all those elements are there and that there isn't anything really nasty being said. But the other stuff that could be taken in another context in a nasty way, because it's in this Purim setting, and together with the Ape Mara consideration, that very often the people being betrayed are physically there and enjoying themselves and laughing and happy to be betrayed. So all of that creates an environment where the context itself colors what's going on, and assuming it's done properly, then one could argue that that's a setting where everything is taken the way it's meant, hopefully with God's help and with proper rabbinical supervision, that is taken in the proper spirit in which it's being offered, and then perhaps in that same sense, that's what allows the Purim spiel here and elsewhere to continue the way it does, and to hopefully accomplish its positive goals without violating anything negative. So we're almost out of time. I just want to quickly review what we spoke about. So we spoke about the fact that Lashon Hara is a major consideration throughout the Torah, and that in the modern context of the medium of the internet and the like, it becomes a specific challenge. And on the one hand, the many tremendous benefits that are there in other areas, but even in the area of speaking about people, sometimes it's necessary and crucial to speak about things so that we can accomplish a valuable purpose of L'Samar Adam Re'echo, or of improving society, or of making positive changes to the environment in which we live. So in order to know when that's the case and when it's not the case, so we have to see everything in its proper context and its proper perspective, to be aware of the fact that the issue of Toelas and Lashon Hara is a discussion drawing on several elements, relying on the fact that Lashon Hara is both a midos concern and a practical damage concern of what it does to our spirit and our character and what it does to other people when they are spoken about. And both of those considerations come into play when we talk about how to evaluate when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate. And we talked about the different conditions, the Chafetz Chaim having seven, others having fewer, but boiling down basically to making sure that we're talking accurately, that we're talking necessarily, and that we're talking without ulterior motive, things along those lines. And in those situations, it could be permissible when everything else fits. And then we talked about the mysterious sentences in the Talmud that Lashon Hara is permissible in public or in the person's presence, both of which we think we would have thought should be worse prohibitions, indeed, as the Chafetz Chaim says. And we went through the different, four different interpretations of what the public means. Either public knowledge could be repeated, but then we saw again only if you're not making it more public and you're not violating the spirit of your midos and you're not damaging the person further. Or maybe it's just not confidential, which is very limited in what that's going to apply to. Or it's a way of ensuring that it will be purposeful. Or it's a way of ensuring that it will be positive, that it won't be taken in an unnecessarily negative context because it's in public, or because the other statement in the Talmud, that is being said in the person's presence. We mentioned some of the other interpretations of what that means, either because it's not two-faced to speak directly to the person, or the Maharal's complex interpretation, that it's not such a misuse of speech, it's a different problem, and that the other person can respond. But in any event, the halacha, we seem to assume if you're speaking in somebody's presence, it's normally worse, unless these mitigating factors are there. So the internet has the potential to have all of the bad issues of these problems without any of the mitigating factors, particularly when taken together with the online disinhibition effect, and especially with anonymity, which creates a whole new level of danger. And then that's not only an issue for what you write, it's also an issue for what you provoke. That's what we see from the concept of Avak Lashon Hara and the issue of Kabbalah Lashon Hara in terms of causing others to be makabel. What you present, all of these are considerations, and of course together with the concern of Anas Tavara and the reality that there are things that you would never say to somebody's face at the Shiva House, Rahman al-Islam, but that you'll say online, and what type of potential damage that could do. So we talked a little bit about the consumer, how the consumer has to take a sensitivity towards Kabbalah Lashon Hara. We talked a little bit about what Kabbalah Lashon Hara means, that it means more than listening. What does it mean specifically was a debate between the Chafetz Chaim and others, whether it's a mental, intellectual issue, or whether it's a practical issue. But either way, it's something beyond listening. But the Chafetz Chaim, assuming that listening itself is a problem, we talked about the difference between the two, and there are times when it's important to listen, if it could potentially be valuable if you're a community leader, if you're somebody who's concerned there might be something there relevant to you, and the like. But at the same time, that requires us to have an even greater distance between Shmiah and Kabbalah. And we talked about how that's an issue that's being addressed in many contexts today, and we talked about some of that discussion as well. And then we talked briefly about the concern of Purim Shpiels, how Purim Shpiels involve sometimes making fun of people in their presence, and is there any permissibility for that? We talked about how many poskim thought that was a very serious concern that is not permissible, and many other traditions, such as the tradition here in Yeshiva, do allow it and encourage it. And in what context could that be? So we discussed the context of Derech Chok, which does not seem to be at all a hetzer. Then the question of Mechila, does Mechila play a role? So it plays a limited role, but it's not an absolute role because of the question of where Mechila is effective and where it's not effective. And then we suggested the most likely avenue to say that it's permitted and appropriate is when the context makes it such that it will be taken in a positive and beneficial light, as we see Tosfos suggesting in terms of in the person's presence, when that is hopefully the case, so then that should be understandably permissible when it's done within that context. We should all have a successful set of others, other Aleph and other Beis, and by the time we get to Purim, we should have a context that creates a proper environment for some of them. Thank you very much.